For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have three interviews for you today. We're going to be talking about two upcoming theatrical productions, one with Kenosha Unified, the other with the Racine Theater Guild. And then we have an interesting interview from the morning show archives, which is appropriate for Women's History Month. Here's part one. This coming weekend, a production is opening here in Kenosha that promises a great deal of color and excitement. It is the Stephen Schwartz musical, The Prince of Egypt. It's being presented by Kenosha Unified under very exciting circumstances because this is a special pilot production under the auspices of Music Theater International. And at the helm of what promises to be a really exciting production is stage director and costume designer Kristen Singer, and we're going to be talking with her about this particular musical, the challenges of mounting it, and the exciting circumstances under which this particular production is being presented both this coming weekend and the following weekend on the stage of Indian Trails High School. Kristen Singer, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. This is a really exciting moment for the music theater program for Kenosha Unified. So let's get this matter out of the way of it being a pilot production. Explain what is behind those intriguing words.
Sure. Well, we're really honored to be asked by MTI to do this as a pilot production. A pilot means that when MTI gets the rights, or any of those companies that are out there get the rights to a musical, they sometimes have to, it's almost like testing it out to make sure that it's exactly how it needs to be before it's published and ready for the rest of the world to be able to license and put on in their cities, in their theaters. So before something comes out, oftentimes they will ask people that they trust and reputable places to do a pilot version where you can give them feedback on the script and how it went. They will sometimes come to see it, or you will send them a recording so they can see what you've done with it. But the biggest honor of it is that they really only let people pilot shows where they really trust their work and know that they're going to do a really beautiful finished product. So for us and our kids here, it's just quite an honor to be asked to do that. And, you know, it was a show that really suited our kids this year, and so I was very happy to say yes, and it's been a really fun process.
Mm. So in other words, this is not an honor for which you applied. Music Theater International, MTI, it sounds like they came to you offering you this opportunity. Is that right?
Yes. That's usually how it works. Like, you know, I've known them over the years from working on other things and being in New York and working on other projects. And so, you know, it's just someone who's in their world. And if they trust your work, they might call you and say, hey, how about doing this? So that's kind of how it went.
So in other words, this is a show that at the moment is not generally available for instance, other schools or for community theaters to be presenting. I mean, this is not yet completely fully available. It has only been done thus far in professional productions, essentially.
What happened with this show is that it was kind of a pandemic show. It opened in the West End, during or prior to the pandemic, I think. And then they were doing runs and the pandemic happened and they had to shut it down. I don't even know if they were fully in production yet when they had to shut down, but there was, the pandemic played a major, major role in what happened with this show. And they ended up, there is a version of it that's available on Amazon Prime that is the recorded stage production and the only one that is out there because it never got to New York. So it was only in the West End and it was during this very hard, difficult time. And they recorded it. You can see they sometimes pan to the audience and everybody is masked. So they recorded it sometime during that awful time in our lives. And I think it just never got the steam to move forward because of the timing. And so MTI got the rights to it, and they decided to, you know, work on it to release it. And actually, sometimes what happens with a pilot is that we talked about this last spring, and so now we're a year later, and I'm doing it now. But in that year, they have had other places in the country do it. It's only like a handful, you know, it's not that many. But they did release it just very, very recently. I'd say maybe as soon as a month ago, they did release it. So it is available now. It's just that when they offered it to us, it was a year ago. And sometimes it's just in the business world, you know, they're like, oh, I think we did get this to the place we need it. And they still let us do the pilot, which means we don't pay for any rights or licensing.
Ah.
It's just gifted to us, which is a tremendous help because musical theater, you know, is a expensive endeavor, even though we try to, you know, use budgets wisely. But getting the rights to things, it's just like buying the rights to sing any kind of music or play any kind of music. You know, you have to pay the people who wrote it. But when you do a pilot, that is waived. But yes, it is available. So that's pretty exciting that it just became available right before we opened. So if people come and see it from other communities, you know, they can also now license it themselves and do it in other places, you know, in Wisconsin or Northern Illinois. So hopefully some people will come see it that are interested in performing it themselves.
We're speaking with Kristen Singer, who is serving as stage director and costume designer as well for a pilot production of the musical The Prince of Egypt, music and lyrics by Stephen Schwartz. I touched on the fact that the essential story of this is the story of Moses. I think probably most of our listeners are at least fairly well acquainted with the basic Old Testament story of Moses. Is there anything that is done with that story in this musical that is, in a sense, out of the ordinary, or is it a fairly straightforward telling of that familiar story?
It is a beautiful telling of the story. I think what is really interesting about it is that it's not only about Moses, but it really showcases a feeling of community and how, you know, in those times people were affected by Seti, the Pharaoh, and, you know, what kind of strife was going on, and how Moses led his people. And it's just such a beautiful story, and features a lot of other characters, which is why it was so perfect for our kids right now, because we have so many talented students, and it was so easy to cast because there's just so much talent, and it just really fit them very well. So not only do you get to see Moses' journey, but you kind of see how you go all the way from him as a baby being floated down the Nile and why his mother had to make that decision, to the queen finding him and deciding to claim him as her own, and how he grew up with a brother that was not blood related, but was related definitely through this family upbringing, and, you know, knowing that they were brothers or thinking they were brothers, I should say. And then later what happens when they find out that they aren't blood related and that they're kind of, you know, from these opposing sides and viewpoints. So it's just such an interesting story with so much conflict, so much love. There's like some funny parts, you know, there's a little lightness here and there. It really encompasses everything you want to see in a musical. Dance, big giant numbers, a lot of beautiful singing, really catchy songs, and it's quite a big spectacle. Mm. It's a really fun piece.
Well, speaking of spectacle, I want to be sure to talk about one really cool aspect of this production. And again, you are the costume designer. So you are, in addition to just staging everything, you're also using your considerable talents as a costume designer for this production. And in the program notes, you make mention of your special connection with the set designer, who is going to also be responsible for that aspect of the visual spectacle that people will be enjoying. Tell our listeners about the set designer of this production and her special connection to you and to Kenosha Unified.
Sure. So a really cool thing about this show is that, you know, it takes more than me to be able to do it. It takes a lot of other adults and professionals in the theater world to put something like this together, because, you know, you want the audience to walk in and go, wow, like, and not think about how it got to the point that it did. But behind the scenes, there are a lot of people working together to make this happen. And what I think is so special about this show is that I was talking to a friend that I grew up with. We did shows together in Kenosha Unified when we were in high school. She and I have kept in touch all this time. She's traveled all over the world. Her name is Elizabeth Shook. She goes by Liz. And so Liz and I grew up together. We were in the Kids from Wisconsin together as singer-dancers. She lived in London for a while, and I was living kind of back and forth from London for a while. So we've just been able to have this friendship over the years. And she became a really profoundly amazing artist. She does a lot of storyboarding. She's worked for places like the BBC. She's constantly working on projects. She designs TED Talks all over the world. She creates her own films. She has her own company. She's been at film festivals all over the world. She's even filmed a few things in Kenosha to come back home and do. So for her to come to this project, she's now living in Canada. So she came here from Canada and is actually on stage right now painting away. It's just really fun to have people that grew up here that learned what theater was and participated in it as a student. And now, you know, she doesn't have to do a job like this to come home and, you know, the job for not a lot of pay and spend a lot of hard work. We don't have a whole crew like you would in a professional setting. It's a lot of, like, you know, her coming in and painting the entire set by herself. I have students that help during the day who have done an amazing job of doing, like, base coats on things and helping putting things together. But at the end of the day, it's her, and it's her design. And I'm just so thrilled that someone who works all over the world and does such amazing things would take the time out to give back to the place where she grew up.
Mm, fantastic. And your program notes point out some other wonderful connections in terms of people like, for instance, your vocal director, Rita Gentile, also a product of Kenosha Unified, and other connections with various people involved in all kinds of different facets of this production. You already mentioned the fact that it was kind of remarkable to hear you say this, but I believe you are saying the truth when you say this was actually an easy show to cast. Even though it's a big show, it requires a ton of singers on stage, but you had the right young people in place to cast this show very impressively.
Yeah, we have so much talent. I told when John Prignano, when I was talking to him about this show, I said, I really have to read it and listen to it and look at the ranges of everything before I can say yes, because I'm not going to say yes until I know that this will be a good opportunity for them. And after I did, I mean, we had auditions shortly after that. And during auditions, I was like, well, this is easy. It just slots right in. I was like, there you go, there you go, there you go. It was probably one of the easiest things I have ever cast.
Wow.
Because it's just sometimes the timing is just correct, you know? And so part of my reason for agreeing to this project was that it just absolutely suited them. And there are, I mean, the leads in the cast are really strong. I would say especially the role of Moses and the role of Ramses, who are two students who are both juniors in high school. And, I mean, they would give those guys on the West End a run for their money. So it's astounding the talent that we have here and just the growth that I've seen in some of these students from, you know, knowing them. We get to know them for a long time because this program is so important, because it just, you see them as freshmen, as sophomores, and every year they grow and mature, and now they're growing into roles like these where last year maybe they weren't ready, you know, but this is the exact right time for them to shine, and it's just going to make them stronger for things in the future or for what they want to do career-wise.
Wonderful. You, I think, have seen up close and personal also the way in which being part of these elaborate, complicated, challenging productions allows these young people to grow in all kinds of ways, even beyond what it means to be a first-rate singer and actor and dancer and performer on the stage. Just the sense of teamwork and focus and commitment and balancing obligations and so on. I mean, it is a proving ground, a gauntlet, and it's just so impressive to see how many of these young people rise to the occasion so very well.
They really love it. You know, I try to make it fun, too. It is a lot of hard work, and it is a lot of hours. You know, I think sometimes people look at the schedule, and they're like, oh, that is a long time, you know? Like, you know, they do. They have homework. You know, we all have other responsibilities outside, especially the kids who have homework and things to study for. I do take that into consideration when I'm making a schedule. Like, we only rehearsed for 4 days a week for the majority of the rehearsal period until we got to March, and then I made it five. So I do try to take into account that, like, these are kids, they have homework and studying, and that is all very important. And then there's this short period of time where they have to be really, really committed and work really hard to get this done, because it has to be after school. And just, they show up and they are happy and they are with their friends and they've made new friends. And it is so important, I think, for them to learn what a commitment looks like and how to see something through and how to balance your life to make something happen. And then when you see the end product, it's just so all worth it. But it helps that they've also had a really great time the whole way through. You know, there are times where it gets like, oh, you guys, like, you got to work. You know, we need to do this again and again and again. You know, but that's anything, and everything takes practice and rehearsal. And, you know, but the general mood every single day, this is why I love what I do, because they're the best people to be around. They are so much fun. We have such a good time. And then to get to do the end product is just like the cherry on top.
Of course. And the other thing that we probably should mention, even though I think most people understand this, is that one of the most special aspects of these productions is that these are not just young people from Indian Trails or from Bradford or from Tremper, but I mean, we're talking about students from all of the high schools coming together in a way that, for instance, does not happen with the football teams or the cheerleaders or whatever. I mean, this is a joint, unified effort, and it's so great to see that.
It is, and I think one of my favorite things was I saw one of the students in the show, who's a Bradford student, wrote in his bio, "I really hope I get to work with all of these people again." And I thought that was just so special because it is a unique thing that they get to meet kids they would never see otherwise. You're not going to get to meet someone who goes to Tremper if you're not involved in something that they do, and what else could that be? So I love that we have this citywide program where we take them from every place and put them all together, and they get here and they meet new friends, and they're going to all cry when it's over, and, you know, it's really healthy and good for them to interact with people that they're not with all during the day.
So this production opens on March 28th. It runs for 2 weekends through April 6th in the auditorium of Indian Trails High School. Before we let you go, Kristen, I want to give you a chance to highlight maybe a couple of the songs that you especially love in this show, or maybe that the kids especially love.
Oh, there's so many. There's a really famous song in it that people might know called "When You Believe." That was a duet. Oh, must have been. It came from the animated movie. So Prince of Egypt was first an animated movie that was really famous, I think, in the 90s, maybe, or the early 2000s. I'm not quite sure. But there was a duet, and it was on the radio. So "When You Believe" is like a well-known tune from it. But the songs are catchy. Like, you leave humming them. And the music is so beautiful, and it has instruments that are reminiscent of that area. So it's things that, like, people maybe haven't heard before. But I think maybe what people will love the most is that there are just these really big, strong choral moments with the entire ensemble. We have 45 students in the show and 2 stage managers plus our crew. So it's a lot of kids, but 45 kids singing something really powerful on stage. It really pulls at your heartstrings. So, you know, it's powerful. And I really hope that people think, oh, it's a high school show. I don't know. But this is a perfect, perfect family outing. It is a beautiful story. You can bring any age kid to come see it. You know, what a great way to spend the day supporting something in the community. And now more than ever, it's really important, especially for us in the arts, for people to support what we're doing. And I just hope we see a really huge turnout to support these amazing kids who would love to perform for a really big audience. It will not disappoint, I promise, and I really hope people buy some tickets and come and see us.
Very good. Again, the production opens March 28th. It runs March 28th, 29th, 7 p.m., and March 30th, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then the same schedule the following weekend, April 4th and 5th, 7 p.m., and Sunday afternoon, April 6th at 2 p.m. in the auditorium, the beautiful auditorium of Indian Trails High School, 6800 60th Street. Get those tickets and come and see what promises to be an amazing, spectacular production of Stephen Schwartz's The Prince of Egypt. And at the helm, Stage Director Kristen Singer. Kristen, thank you so much for taking the time for this conversation. Best wishes to you, your cast, and crew for The Prince of Egypt.
Thank you, Greg. I hope everyone comes and sees us.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD. Your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And for part two of today's morning show, we are going to be talking about a comedy that is opening tomorrow night at the Racine Theater Guild. It's a play called Always a Bridesmaid by Jesse Jones, Nicholas Hope, and Jamie Wooten. And I'm happy to have on the phone Michael Klickner, who is the director of this production, We're going to find out about the play, the story that it tells, and what people can expect to get to the Racine Theatre Guild between now and April 13th, which is when this production closes. Michael Klickner, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Great to be talking with you again, and great to be talking with you about what sounds like a really delightful comedy. First of all, when you were given the opportunity to direct Always a Bridesmaid, is this a play you had encountered before or knew anything about?
I have actually never heard of this play in my lifetime. I've not even heard of these playwrights. Apparently, the Theatre Guild has done plays by them before. I'm not sure which ones they were, but no, Doug asked me if I wanted to direct it, and I said sure that I would. Little did I know at the time that there was a cast of six women and no men whatsoever. So, you know, they've been ganging up on me and treating me poorly the whole time. So.
Well, we'll leave that for another time to talk about. But in the meantime, no, it sounds like it's been a really great time from what I understand from a couple of cast members whom I know. I really love the central premise of this play. Explain to our listeners kind of the heart and soul of the story of Always a Bridesmaid.
Well, the story is basically about a group of women, four women in particular, who have been friends since the seventh grade. And when they couldn't get dates to the prom, their high school prom, and they swore to one another after breaking into their father's liquor cabinet and drinking way too much for kids, and they decided that they would swear to be bridesmaids in one another's wedding. Little did they know there would be multiple weddings between them and that this would go on for many, many years. And in fact, it goes on so long that one of the original women, one of the bridesmaids, her daughter is now a bride, and they all become bridesmaids for that daughter. And it's extremely funny. It is a comedy, and it should be a comedy. It's very funny, but I also think that it's kind of sort of a love story of these four friends who've been together for so many years, as I said, since the seventh grade, and they're now in their late 40s. So they've been together a long time. It's also kind of funny. One of the funniest parts in the play for me is three of them have lived in Virginia all their lives, and they have the fourth one who came to them in seventh grade, and she transferred down there from Connecticut. And they treat her like a foreign exchange student, so pretty funny.
So, yeah, it sounds like there is something really funny, of course. It's what you want in a comedy. But there's also some real emotional authenticity in the way that this play has been written and the way that these four main characters have been drawn.
It's true. That's true. I mean, you can tell that they actually like one another. They're sort of become a family, and you know how families sort of have a love-hate relationship sometimes, that you don't always like them, but you always love them. So
tell us more about these four women who form kind of the heart and soul of the story and how distinct they are from one another. I mean to what extent they are four really unique individuals who nevertheless feel like good friends.
Well, there's Libby Ruth, who is the mother of the bride-to-be that we talked about a little bit earlier. Libby Ruth is kind of a down-to-earth, everybody should love one another and take care of one another, and everything is beautiful in its own way, sort of a woman. Then you have Monette. Let us back up just a second. Libby Ruth and her husband own a diner. Then you have Monette, who owns the biggest nightclub in Virginia. And she's very eccentric, and she's very much into her looks and the way she looks and how she carries herself and everything. Then we have Deidre, who is a judge. She's the one who comes from Connecticut, and she's very no-nonsense. Everything is very matter-of-fact. And then the last one we have is Charlie, and Charlie owns an environmental type center where they sell plants and trees and all that kind of stuff. And they call her the Earth Mother. And she is very much, not the kind of dress-up kind of girl that certainly Monette is. Monette is all about her look and being pristine and pretty all the time. And Deidre wears pants and Birkenstocks, and it's just very middle, down-to-earth sort of thing. So, yeah, they're quite different, but yet they're very similar in the fact that they really, they're there for one another all the time. I mean, every time there's a wedding that needs bridesmaids from one of them, they're there, and without question, no matter how sick or one of them breaks her foot, and she shows up anyway. So they're quite different.
So it sounds like we have more than four weddings between these four women.
Well, what you see during the course of the play is actually, you only see the one wedding, which is the daughter, but then you see the others getting ready. Libby Ruth has already been married and is very happily married, and you never see anything about her. Monette is on her third wedding. Deidre has two weddings, and Charlie is supposed to have one wedding, but you'll have to find out whether or not she goes through with it or not. So,
So as the director, as the director, what is the challenge in terms of making this comedy as funny as it can be? I mean, what have you and your cast mostly been working on?
Well, timing of everything and making sure that they say the lines the way that I interpreted them to make them be as funny as possible. I tell people when I'm working on this with this group of women, and it's kind of sort of like herding cats because they're constantly trying new things and different, and we're always laughing. The cast is always laughing, I mean, at one another and everything going on, and there's just so much comedic stuff that happens with these four women and their lives and the different bridesmaids' dresses that they wear. They're very unique, and I don't want to say too much more about that because it's a visual thing that happens during the play that you have to see. So, we just work on what's going on and what's being said to one another and how they're saying it. As I said, they're really good friends, and really good friends talk to one another different than strangers do. Mm. And they say things that you wouldn't say to anybody else, but they do.
And especially when friends have been friends for as long as these women have been friends.
Exactly. They've been friends, as I said, since the seventh grade. They've all known one another. And that's a pretty rare thing in our society, I think, where people have friends that they've known since they were young. I mean, some people have friends that they've known seems like forever, and then there's some that, friends come and go.
The play again is Always a Bridesmaid. It opens tomorrow night at the Racine Theater Guild, and it runs through April 13th. And you can go to racinetheater.org, or you can call the box office at 262-633-4218 for ticket information. Michael Klickner, the director of this production. Michael, thank you for your time. Best wishes to you and your cast and crew for Always a Bridesmaid.
Thank you very much.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. I hold in my hands one of the latest books to come from the good people at National Geographic, and this book is something extra special, and I am very, very happy that we can talk about it. It's called Girls Can: Smash Stereotypes, Defy Expectations, and Make History. This is a book definitely intended for young readers, but just about anybody will derive great inspiration from exploring this book, in which we learn about all kinds of extraordinary women through the course of history who have made an enormous difference in the world in all kinds of different arenas. And the book is beautiful to look at and endlessly fascinating. One of the people responsible for it
is a writer and poet by the name of Paige Towler, who has a long history with National Geographic, a book editor there for National Geographic Kids for 5 years. And her work has appeared in such anthologies as Hey Baby and the National Geographic Book of Nature. And this book, again, is titled Girls Can. And Paige Towler, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much, Greg. So glad to be here.
I'm glad we can be having this conversation. The book is so inspiring, and it's not only inspiring to read, but I'm sure it would be tremendously inspiring to write. Tell us a little bit about the creative process by which this book came together and the precise role that you played in the crafting of this book.
Absolutely. So I am one of three authors on this book. I worked with Marissa Sebastian and Tora Shea Pruden, both fantastic women. And I really can't emphasize enough how much of a group effort this was, not just from the three of us, but also from the designers and photo editors and fact checkers and regular editors, or rather, I mean, text editors, and also people at other divisions at National Geographic. We were lucky enough to work with people who could help us profile some of the amazing National Geographic explorers who are actually out in the field making huge changes for the environment. And we were lucky to work with the adult book team who put out books for a mature audience, and work with them in getting some interviews with amazing people like Oprah, Roxane Gay, and more.
I think one of the things that is intriguing to me is that when we read this book, there are all kinds of women whom we have certainly heard of, like Oprah Winfrey and Susan B. Anthony and Madame Curie and so on, but then all kinds of women whose names will not be nearly so well known. And of course, we're talking about a whole planet from which to choose. I mean, this is really this book is global in its scale and wide ranging in terms of its historical span as well. How hard was it to figure out which women to highlight, and what kinds of things did you think about and weigh in making those choices?
Certainly, it was definitely really difficult. I mean, there could be an infinite number of these books, honestly, because the amount of amazing women out there just goes on and on. And you bring up a really wonderful point, which is that we did want to highlight a lot of unknown stories in addition to the more established ones. And that is because we really wanted to prove the point that these things have been happening throughout history. Women have been doing amazing things, and part of the problem is just that their stories aren't being told or highlighted as important. So we were really excited to be able to break it down by time period, by subjects such as sports versus science, and of course to highlight stories from all around the globe and just show an amazing abundance of change and leadership and passion and brilliance from women throughout history.
Why don't you choose a couple of the lesser-known women whose stories you think are especially remarkable, and whose stories are found in this book?
Absolutely, yes. Two of my, I should say, favorite stories, which of course they're all my favorites, but two that I find particularly inspiring and that I had never heard of were Inhedwana and Edmonia Lewis. Inhedwana actually lived thousands of years ago in the Assyrian Empire, and she is the first known writer. So basically, out of all of history, she is the first author whose name we know. It's not the oldest piece of writing, but she's the first author to have her name on something. And the fact that there's something that monumental, and it's a female author, and I had no idea, really inspired me. We don't know whether Inhedwana was her title or her name, but we do know that she was really kick butt in that she was a priestess. She was responsible for uniting a couple of different groups of people under her visions, and on the side, she actually wrote her own personal poetry. So she was just a great visionary leader and talented poet. And then more recently, Edmonia Lewis was a sculptor in the 1800s. She was born after enslaved people had been freed, and she was born
to a freed father and an Ojibwe mother. So she came from a background that was extremely marginalized, and the odds were very stacked against her, not just being a woman, but being a woman of color from two very, very put upon and discriminated against backgrounds. Despite all of that, despite an early upbringing of extreme adversity, she actually became a masterclass sculptor and studied in Italy under the best. And I had seen Edmonia Lewis's works, actually, when I was vacationing, and I thought, you know, this is incredible, but I had no idea about her story. And it's just a testament to not only her natural skill, but this woman's incredible determination to create beautiful art despite the odds being completely stacked against her.
One of the points that recurs through the book is sort of a parade of different myths that for such a long time have held back certain women from achieving all that they might, or held back women from dreaming about possibilities kind of beyond the standard stereotypes and so on. What was it like to kind of think about those important myths and to sort of set them up so they could be in effect dashed as we read your book?
Right. It was, I have to say, honestly, it was surprising and frustrating, but ultimately definitely liberating to dive into a lot of research. The thing about these myths is the surprising and frustrating part is just how frequent they are. You know, if you go online into different forums or sometimes just talking to people, they will bring up myths about women in leadership, myths even about the way women's brains are structured, you know, silly things that are completely outdated but still hold sway over the way people think. So it was definitely a daunting task trying to collect some of the most popular myths for each category and then to dive into different research papers, different published journals, and really find, just in addition to common sense, you know, scientific information that would let us, for, of course, at an appropriate kid's age, just dash them to pieces. Mm.
We open the book with a chapter devoted to leadership, and this is a wonderful array of women with people from Cleopatra and Queen Elizabeth the First all the way to present-day politicians and CEOs, and then we meet some great adventurers and athletes, some great writers and artists, some great scientists and mathematicians, and then I think the book really ends with a bang with Chapter 5, which is titled Changing the World, which features a succession of really incredible and inspiring women who, in one way or another, have helped to change the world, and people from the pages of history like Susan B. Anthony and Sojourner Truth, straight through to the present day. What would be one of the women from this part of the book that you think is especially worth knowing?
Sure, I was really glad to include Sojourner Truth's story. We paired her closely with Susan B. Anthony because Sojourner Truth really shows a glossed over history of women's rights. We idolize Susan B. Anthony, and we all know most people know the amazing and incredible strides she made for getting the vote for women. And we do profile her, but where she fell down really was on intersectionality. So she did not promote rights for Black women. And Sojourner Truth came along and shed a light on so many voices that were being overlooked and really had so much to add to this movement. So we were really excited to be able to look at things from multiple perspectives and sort of pull back the curtain on aspects that may have been glossed over or not taught as much, and tell the story of a woman who just refused to be silenced and refused to be told that she was less than.
There is an intriguing spread towards the very end of the book, which is devoted to boys. Explain what this page is about and why you and your collaborators felt like it was important to take a brief moment for boys.
absolutely. So, of course, this book is devoted to raising up and empowering women and smashing myths against them. But one of the most important messages to, I think, bring more people to get behind women's empowerment is to really emphasize how it helps everybody. It helps girls, it helps boys, it helps people who don't identify as either. It's really good for society in general, basically. So the idea with this spread was to show that boys don't have to be held back by gender biases or stereotypes too, and to touch on how these things also can be damaging to boys. For example, I think, you know, everyone's heard the phrase, boys don't cry or boys shouldn't cry. Today, boys are told that they shouldn't like pink. You know, oftentimes men in traditionally, quote unquote, nurturing positions can be looked down upon. And we wanted to show that that's all ridiculous, basically. And that smashing down gender stereotypes is something that liberates absolutely everyone.
Let's close by giving you a chance to describe what this book looks like visually. It's one of the things that I really appreciate. I mean, for as much substance as there is in the text, the way this book looks is also really important in terms of what I think will be its appeal to young readers.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. We have an incredibly talented team. Our designer, Amanda Larson, really did an amazing job setting this up to look very graphic, I should say. It looks a lot like there are a lot of graffiti elements. It looks like someone's out there, you know, starting a revolution, basically. It's got a lot of brilliant, unexpected, bold colors, and there are a lot of layouts that feature really cute icons and graphics. We also have, of course, as usual for National Geographic, wonderful photos, thanks to our photo editor, Lori Epstein, and some specially commissioned illustrations for the women who, you know, don't actually have historical records of what they visually looked like. Each spread is broken down either to feature two women or one woman, so it's really easy to dive in and dip out. You can read it from front to back. You can start wherever you like. It's just very accessible, very, very beautiful, and really feels like it has a lot of energy and excitement to it.
I completely agree. The book, again, is titled Girls Can, Smash Stereotypes, Defy Expectations, and Make History. A marvelous celebration of women around the world and down through history. The book comes from National Geographic, and one of its creators, Paige Towler. Paige Towler, thank you so much. Congratulations to you and your collaborators on giving the world, I think, a really important book. And thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we speak to the author of a graphic novel for young readers called Very Bad at Math. The main character, an otherwise successful high school student, struggles terribly with math because she has a condition called dyscalculia. That happens to be something that the author herself suffers from as well, related to dyslexia but involving the swapping of numerals rather than letters. In part two of tomorrow's program, we'll hear from the author of a book called Math Explains the World. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, on Thursday, April 3rd, there will be an event at Founders Hall at Historic Kemper Center, sponsored by the Four Seasons Garden Club. Turn your garden into the perfect B&B for birds. This is a free event, but you need to contact the Four Seasons Garden Club to register for this free event through Eventbrite. Cloudy skies and mild today, a high of 59 degrees with a 50% chance of rain developing after midnight, a low of 43. A 50% chance of rain tomorrow morning, but then sunny, windy, and quite warm. Tomorrow's high, 76 degrees. Rain is likely on Saturday and Sunday. This is WGTD.